here we are again. So I think all of us, maybe except for Jeff, were here last week. Is that right? Were you here last week? You were in Las Vegas, I think.
I was in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Oh, good. All right. Excellent. Maybe as we go along, I'll summarize a little bit what happened yesterday, but not too much.
I attended that one.
Oh, yeah, you were at the Dharma talk. Okay. Yeah, yeah, I know you picked it up there, yeah. Yeah, that was more or less the same. So, I want to start today's class, as promised, with the story of where the Metta Sutta came from according to the commentaries. So this is not in the Nikaya, it's not in the Pali canon. But I'm learning more and more that in addition to the canon itself, there's a quite important and pretty ancient, you know, set of commentaries, and that a traditional early Buddhist monk would always sort of have both side by side. And these commentaries were written down starting in the more or less birth of Christ time. And the ones that survive were probably written mostly in southern India and Sri Lanka. And they mostly were written, I guess, in Sinhalese, which is the language of Sri Lanka. And then later they were like organized and translated sort of forward or back, depending on how you want to think about it, into Pali to kind of give them a little more, you know, ecclesiastical sort of oomph and staying power, you know, because the southern monks of Sri Lanka and South India, who had, you know, were like invested in Pali as the sort of lingua franca of Buddhism, and so this was like part of that effort, apparently. So very practical on their part, and, you know, with a little sort of domineering style, as all human beings like to do, right? So anyway, this story is from the commentary, and you know, whether it's true or not, who knows, but who knows that about anything. So the story is, one time the Buddha was teaching in the town of Savasti. He had this kind of circuit he would go. And it was a little bit before the rains retreat, which is like the practice period, the annual practice period, which is it's the monsoon season. And during the monsoon season, the monks would try to find one's place, monks and nuns, and not travel as much. And I always thought it was because like the roads are bad, but it turns out it's because you do damage the crops if you walked in any fields. And so you're like out of respect and protectiveness of the crops. And Fran knows another detail.
I thought it was because the animals would come up in the mud and they'd be squishy and killing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Things.
So three likely reasons, yeah. Bad roads, worms, and farms, yeah. So anyway, it became the tradition, whether, you know, it probably had some basis in practicality, but was actually a religious, you know, observance. And anyway, so it's almost that time, so the monks have got to figure out where they're going to spend the rains, because then you're not supposed to move. And so a bunch of monks were with the Buddha, getting instruction, you know, like sort of instructions before this long retreat. And I'm going to read you the translation of the description of the instructions, because one thing that's neat about the early Buddhist stories is they give you a little kind of window into how the Buddha operated. So it says, "The Buddha expounded meditation subjects suitable for the 84,000 shades of temperament." You know, so we're all different. There are 84,000 versions of people. And he has got a different subject for each one. And there he had expounded meditation subjects for these 84,000 shades of temperament in the following way. For those of lustful temperament, he showed loathsomeness as a meditation subject of the 11 kinds, as with consciousness and without consciousness. So, you know, different teachings for people who are lustful. For those of hating temperament, he taught the fourfold mindfulness subject beginning with loving kindness. For those of deluded temperament, he taught the meditation subject consisting of mindfulness of death. For those of a speculative thinking temperament, that's us, right? Speculative thinking temperament. He taught the mindfulness of breathing, the earth, universal, etc. And for those of a faithful temperament, the subjects consisted of the recollection of the enlightened ones, etc. I think it stands for a big long list of teachings that we don't know. And for those of intelligent or discerning temperament, he taught the definition of the four elements. So, you know, different stuff for different folks, you know. And then amongst this enormous group of monks, you know, huge numbers of monks, it says there's a group of 500 monks. And I guess 500 is a sort of canonical code for a lot of them. It doesn't exactly mean more than, you know, 500 exactly. And so these 500 monks were quite impressed with his teachings and wanted to go like a little further away than all the other ones for a really quiet spot to practice. So they hiked their way, you know, mindfully walked their way for several days to the foothills of the Himalaya. They went north. And as they found a really beautiful spot. The story says they found a spot where the surface of the surface, I'm sure the surface of what? Of a lake, maybe? The surface glittered like blue quartz crystal. It was embellished with a cool, dense, shady green forest grove and a stretch of ground strewn with sand, resembling a net or a silver sheet, and it was furnished with a clean spring of grateful, cool water. It says that, grateful, cool water. Water that is grateful to be drunk. So they found a really good spot, and they did a night of meditation, and they were quite happy and overjoyed with their beautiful spot for meditation. And they went into the town the next morning, as they would, like we talked about last week, for their daily food with their bowls. And the villagers were really happy with them, too. They were peaceful, wonderful monks, and the villagers were so happy to have monks there. This is like little outskirts that usually have, you know, fully ordained people there, I guess. And so they're so happy, and they begged the monks to definitely stay there for the rains retreat. And gave them really nice food, and it says that, and they made them huts, 500 huts, in one day. They made 500 huts. So they had a really good, like, lumber store there, too, I guess. And which included, it says, such necessities as beds, chairs, pots, and so on. So someone's little village had everything needed for the 500 monks. And there's some stuff about another village was happy with them. So everyone around there was really happy with them. And so it started out great. They felt so welcomed. They did a very rigorous schedule of meditation in the afternoon and throughout the night, and mostly alone in their little huts, but then they'd come together every morning to sort of gather, you know, check in and go into the town for begging. And for the first few days, everyone looked great, radiant, peaceful. The teachings were really, you know, in action. Things were good. It says in there that they were like royalty. They're so beautiful in their practice. But then, after a few nights, they started having some trouble. In the middle of the night, they started having disturbing visions during their meditation and hearing creepy sounds. And there's quite, and they felt, let's see, I'll read you some of this. They were dreadful, it appeared to be like there were dreadful, phantasmical things right in front of them, making terrible sounds, and there were forms and noises, and they were pale, and the bhikkhus, the monks, became pale and jaundiced and could no longer unify their cognizance. They couldn't focus, they couldn't concentrate. And so the nights get really long, you know, when these weird things are happening. And then when they'd gather in the morning, they were like all too embarrassed to say what was going on. But they could, you know, after a while you can kind of tell everyone else seems to be a wreck too. It's not just you. Like they're like us, I think. They all thought, oh, it's just me, you know, I'm not doing this right. The others are quite peaceful. And then it says, finally, the sort of leader said, asked them what's going on. The senior elder of the committee asked the other monks, friends, when you first entered into this wood, the color of your skin was quite pure and bright, and your faculties were clear. But now you are lean and pale and jaundiced. What does not suit you here? You know, what's going on? And one of the monks finally admitted what was going on. He said, venerable sir, at night I saw and heard such and such a dreadful object. I smelt, oh yeah, terrible smells too, like really stinky smells. And I smelt such and such a terrible smell, and my mind could not be concentrated, and I could not practice. And then one by one they all copped to having this terrible experience all night, you know. And so they decided, well, what do you do when you're in doubt? They decided, we got to go talk to the Buddha. So they, you know, told the villagers they had to go talk to the Buddha, and they went on. And it doesn't say how long they walked, but I'm always struck by these stories of early Buddhism in all the Asian countries, that the monks spend quite a bit of time walking. And I think that's a sort of core part of their practice. It doesn't get written about so much, I think, because it was so ordinary, you know. That's how everyone got around, you know. But I think we might benefit from walking. You know, when Fran goes to the Southwest, she should walk there, you know. She probably a lot here. Yeah. Have to get another hip by the time you get there, but it's all right. So anyway, they went to the Buddha, and the Buddha, with his incredible divine powers, he has like all these powers. He could tell what was going on was that there were earth spirits in that neck of the woods. Sometimes they're called earth spirits or devas. Sometimes they're called tree devas, who were quite happy in their woods and felt a little invaded by the monks. And I guess it was kind of like when somebody comes to stay with you, who's like a pretty nice person, you know, and you're glad to have them stay for a night. And then the next day, you notice that they, you know, are quite comfortable in your refrigerator now. And then you overhear them on your phone, like ordering something, you know, and having it mailed to your house and like that. I think that so the idea of the story is that the tree spirits are not particularly malevolent spirits, but they were not pleased with this sort of invasion of 500 monks, and they worked together to sort of scare the monks away to have some peace, you know. And so the Buddha could tell this, and the Buddha said that what they should do is, the Buddha was at first a little alarmed. Excuse me, I'm telling the story in the wrong order. The Buddha was first a little alarmed that they showed up because the rains had already started. He said to them, "Bhikkhus, it is a training rule that has been made known by me that no one should go wandering during the rains. Why are you wandering? You know, what are you doing back here?" And so they explained all that, and you could tell it was the tree devas. And then he told them, "Well, what you should do is you need a powerful teaching to help you, and it will also help these spirits." And so he composed on the spot and taught them the Metta Sutta. So that's where the Metta Sutta comes from, according to the story. And he told them that they should memorize and recite the Metta Sutta, which I think is an important point for us, because we tend to see texts as sort of vehicles for content, you know what I mean? That the words are sort of like a nice container, and we always want to know what's inside so we can sort of consume it, you know, and then we don't really care about the container. But the suttas are understood in a little bit different way, that the sutra or the sutta itself is an object of veneration and study and support. So the suttas often mentioned, and the Mahayana sutras even more so, you know, that just memorizing one line from the sutra is more powerful than any practice you could do. Just reciting one line or having faith in one line in the sutra. And so that's a big part of the Buddhist tradition, you know, which we can work with and think about is, it's not about the content, you know, it's about the actual sutra itself. And so he told them to memorize and recite and chant this sutra. And so, and they said, "Oh, okay, but isn't there somewhere else we can practice? You know, it's kind of creepy up there, you know. We don't really want to go back there. Well, we'll do this practice, but we really don't want to go back there. What would be a better place to practice?" And so the Buddha cast his vision out in each direction, and it goes in great detail. He looked first to the northeast, you know, and then to the east. He looked all over the world for a good place, and he looked everywhere that he could, and he could see everywhere. And he said, "Well, the only good place for you to practice is that exact spot. You know, that's the only place that you can practice this." And they said, "Okay." And they hiked back, chanting the Metta Sutta as they went. And as they approached the spot back in the woods, they were reciting the sutra, and the spirits could hear that, and they were overjoyed. The whole situation was you know, fixed up. And there are various versions of the story where the tree deities fly down and help them and hold their stuff and, you know, get them all set up and really welcome them back. So that's where the Metta Sutta came from, according to the commentary. Isn't that a nice story? So last time, we didn't really have so much time for discussion, and you didn't really get to speak with each other, which I value. It was more me sending out material. which I'm glad you enjoyed, but I thought we'd pause on that mode and spend some time in discussion of these 15 virtues that are listed in the beginning of the sutta for those who would like to practice in this way. And what I thought we'd do, let's see how many people we have here. Six of you, that's good. I think maybe what we'll do is we'll break up for a few minutes with a partner, and I'm going to give you another handout that has these virtues listed on it. And let's bring up together, I'll remind you a little bit the format of this kind of conversation, but let's bring up together just the question of these virtues. Is this a good list? Is the list are these the ones you would have put on the list? Does something seem missing or strange or inapplicable? There were the two or three items that we discussed last time that seemed to be sort of targeted directly at monks and nuns living this very simple lifestyle. How can we work with these qualities, especially the ones about not having too many responsibilities, not being too busy, and also the one that we talked about that was the most difficult to translate, about support from family or support for family. Are those ones that we need to sort of turn in some way, or can we work with them directly? And let's just contemplate and speak with our partner about, do any of these seem harder or easier to work with? Are there sort of particular obstacles that come up for us? You know, what's really hard for me about being gentle and receptive is such and so. And let's just spend a few minutes on that and just see how we kind of relate to all this before we go on with the actual practice of metta as it's described in the next section. So let me, I made 5 copies of this, so we might need to share. So let me pass this out. Thanks. And let me remind you as we're passing this out a little bit about the format of this, which is we'll go with our partner off to different corners of the room where we don't hear the others as much. And we'll sit together, close together, so we can hear each other. And then I'll ring a bell and we'll just meditate for a moment. Not to sort of figure out what we're going to say or figure anything out, but just to settle. Just to settle. And then we'll take turns speaking and listening. And the thing about this is when your partner is speaking, to really just practice listening, just letting the words come in without reaction or response, just bearing witness. It's more like bearing witness than having a conversation. And not to do sort of the social reassurances that we usually do. Yeah, that reminds me of something. But just to listen, just let the person speak. And if the person who's speaking runs out of stuff to say in the 5 minutes or so we'll spend, which would be nice, because usually we don't have more than like 2 minutes, because I'm always jamming this in at the end, so see, do it in the middle. So anyway, if you can't think of anything else to say, then just sit quietly and see if anything else comes up. Because sometimes, like, you say what's obvious to yourself or what you think the other person wants to hear on some level, and then you sit quietly for a while and you realize something else that you want to say. So we'll just give our partner the space to do that. We won't like say, oh, well, if you're done, I'll start early. We'll just give it the whole 5 minutes. And then let's also agree that whatever we say in these conversations can stay here in this room, can be private. We won't bring it up later. You know, when we were having that conversation in class, I wanted to say this, but I couldn't. You know, we'll just let it be here so that we all still feel free to say whatever is true for us right now, you know what I mean? Which might not be true for us after we leave, you know, these things change. So let's let it be just sort of a quiet bearing witness and not like, you know, anything we really keep track of. Just something we speak from this moment. Okay, should we do that? So maybe we kind of break up pretty obviously in pairs here. Once you head off to the corner with your partner and if you don't know each other's names, be sure and introduce yourself, and then let's just sit quietly, and I'll ring the bell for meditation. So, did anything interesting come out of that? Makes sense to share? You think of anything interesting, or you don't have to share anything too private, but.
You know, it's always interesting when we do these things.
Yeah.
It's no matter what, out of here, I always feel like, oh yeah, I got that too. Yeah, I got that too. You know, it doesn't. But we were certainly sharing about having too many duties and too many applications.
Yeah.
What a struggle that is.
Yeah.
And I've really been trying to work with this just one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
One thing at a time. And the rest of it is all just in my head.
Right.
You know? But it's so hard not to be thinking about, well, what are the consequences going to be if I don't do this, if I don't do that. But
right.
It's not there. So I.
Yeah.
As well as, here's the other one.
Mm-hmm.
With the precept study, you know, I'm doing that, looking at right speech, and so I've been looking at I'm a student first.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this friend coming to visit who who is, again, trying to be speech, high maintenance. I mean, he's high maintenance.
Yeah.
And so I want to take off for a while, actually, while he's gone. But, and I have this difficulty in all kinds of other relationships, too, but I don't want to say, well, look, you're just difficult for me, I take off. You know?
Yeah.
And then we talked about it, and we'll tell him you're on a retreat.
Uh-huh.
Which is
true, yeah.
Which is true, but,
yeah.
You know, I've been trying to be on a retreat all summer.
Right.
So anyway, it's that kind of thing. And I have another friend. I just visited her in the hospital the other day. And she too is I don't know what the word is, but I just use the word kind of. Needs a lot of, she's needy, but she's also, what's the word? I don't know how to describe it. So I thought, ooh, I can go visit her in the hospital, and then I'm more in control of my
kids. Oh.
So you know, if I'm there. But anyway, so those are a couple of the things that come up, along with the rest of them.
Uh-huh. Else, or should we move on with the sutra? Yeah, those are good points. And I remember Lorna was here last week, and she was basically saying, well, these two about duties and responsibilities, like, that's not even possible for us, you know what I mean? Forget that, you know? And she had a kind of a point, you know what I mean? And, you know, I sort of made the sort of classical Zen response, which was like, well, how you do things and your attitude matters, and, you know, you can still be doing these activities. And like Kathy's saying, you know, multitasking is sort of a, you know, sort of a stressful thought on top of an activity, you know. But yeah, she does have a point. These are, you know, we're in a situation where we're called upon to take a lot of responsibilities, yeah, so how can we? And then it also makes me think, you know, how do these virtues, or the ways that these virtues work together, you know what I mean? It might be that by emphasizing our capableness and our uprightness, you know, and our prudence and our humility, maybe in those kind of other virtues working together maybe help us to approach our busyness in a different way, but who knows?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So this, the words in this are having few duties. Is that in our, when the one we can't, does it refer to duties?
Well, it sort of has this catch-all about not being submerged by the things of the world, which seems to be sort of touching both of those, but it doesn't really appear to have a literal translation of those two. And the one, Apakicho, that's like responsibilities, duties like responsibilities. And the second one is just plain not doing too much stuff, The second one is activities.
In the translation, the activities.
Yeah.
Which kind of to me implies that we have them, but we don't have to be bent down and burdened by them. I mean, that's just another.
Yeah. Unburdened by with duties.
Now that could mean not, you know, not having them or not carrying them as a burden.
Right.
When you have them.
Right, right. How you hold things.
How you hold
makes
things.
All the difference. Yeah. Yeah, and Fran was nice enough to write out the third translation, and not this time, but maybe next time. I found some recordings of people singing it in that style, so we can listen to that. And so there's just a sort of one of the dominant English translations is sung, and yeah, and translation is there, is like Fran says, is
this is
unburdened with duties, unburdened with duties. So anyway, back. So let's at least get a couple verses in before we part. Then. Otherwise, we won't make any progress, and we will have, you know, we have the responsibility here. We have to get busy. We can't just talk about this stuff. So the first section is about all these virtues, and it ends in the middle of the third stanza with this catch-all. Do you have my handout with the little chart? That's really good for this. And then then in the middle of the third stanza, it breaks to the second section, which is, well, how do you actually do this? You know, what is the practice of metta, and how do you approach that? So, and the other thing I'm learning is, it's interesting that the friend bringing up the English translation that's sung, I think it's a central practice that you sing these things, so maybe eventually we'll move to one that's sung, or maybe we'll all learn Pali or something, but listening into the third verse, ending this first section and starting the next, it'll go. Imagine singing that, it wouldn't be that hard to learn, would it, you know? Suki no ta kimi no hanto. So these words are interesting to look at in detail because this is the hinge of the whole sutra. So I'm going to get, like, with my newfound, Pali knowledge, which is all cribbed from other scholars, I'm going to now sound very smart. So this phrase, Suki no ba kimi no hanto sabe satta Bhavantu Sukhitata. So it starts and ends with two different versions of the same word. Did you notice that? That's Sukhi, Sukhi no, Sukhitata. So these are versions of the word Sukha. And we've heard of the word Dukkha, which is like suffering in different ways. And so this is the opposite. This is happiness. Happiness. So it starts and ends with happiness. And so the question is, why does it say happiness twice? And apparently this isn't really supported by the Pali construction directly, but the commentaries, again, see, the commentaries are how people learn about this early Buddhist works. The commentaries say that the first happiness, the Sukhi no, refers to physical well-being, so good health and not non-illness. And then the one at the end refers to what we think of as happiness, like mental, positive mental conditions. Which isn't like so much like sort of gleeful joy, like jumping up and down because we got something, but, sort of a general sense of sort of solid well-being and rootedness and happiness. So that's the beginning and the end. So we have sort of three types of points they're making. The first is physical well-being. The third is mental happiness, we could say. And then there's one in the middle, this word kemino, basically means safe. Safe and secure, and it's a construct. The chem part means like a fence, so it's like a fence around a field, keeping the livestock safe. It's from an agrarian culture, right? This material. So we're fenced off. We're safe, protected from danger by these teachings. And the other thing that's interesting in there is that there are two different imperative verbs. I guess there are two sort of synonyms. Hantu. So Sukhi no va kemi no hantu. Hantu means, may this be, may they be. And then sabe, the next word, is all. Sata is beings. So may this be for all beings. And then bhavantu, the next word, is just another form of the last imperative verb. May they really be, you know what I mean? So literally it's kind of like physical well-being and safety. May all beings have this. May all beings really have this. May they be happy. So that's what it's wishing for. And I'm actually glad to learn that because we'll talk later about this different meditation practices around metta. And they often involve working with the phrase. And they're actually, what I realize is there are different translations of this phrase. And I'm like, well, what is the right phrase? I'm like, it all comes from this. And so it always should have those three elements, it turns out. You know, physical well-being, or, you know, healthiness, safety, and happiness. And then the safety, it can be understood, you know, in sort of a literal way, like nobody's going to attack you or harm you, or, you know, no wild animals are going to eat you or something. But we can understand safety in, you know, in a metaphorical and a psychological way, too, of course, you know. How can we really have happiness if we don't feel safe, you know, and secure? So that sort of establishes the next section. This is basically saying, okay, now this is what this is really about. This is what we want. How should you go about generating this wish for loving kindness? And we actually don't have the word metta so far at all. I mentioned that comes a little bit later. So next we're going to have lists of beings. And I think what's interesting about these lists of beings and Buddhist sutras are really sort of characterized by many different lists and divisions, you know. And it was partly the sort of philosophical métier, I think, of, you know, medieval India, that they sort of thought about things that way. Like, okay, well, I mean all beings, but what do I mean when I say all? You know, what does it actually mean? Well, it means this kind and that kind. And you might think I'm including this kind, but I'm not. There's also this kind, and don't forget about that kind, and these long lists. So that's kind of one, I think, just sort of how they thought about things. But the other shade of meaning here is that this is not just a sort of list to make a point. You know, it's not just, we see this as sort of making emphasis and sort of cute. You know, like, well, we got it the first time. We know what all means, you know. We think it's kind of sweet. But actually, it's when they make these long lists, they're meditation instructions. They're actually saying, no, literally, you should first try to hold your mind on the feeling of loving kindness for all beings. But that might be a little hard to do. So then, hold your mind on a feeling of loving kindness towards all weak beings. Really, you know, really direct that loving kindness towards weak beings, and then this kind of beings, and then that kind of beings, and so on and so on and so on. Like, you know, step by step, sort of very step by step. And these lists are sort of funny for us because they're not the way we would chop it up. You know what I mean? We would chop it up in different ways, but we can understand it in that way. Is realize the way that you categorize things. And use that categorization to your, you know, as a spiritual tool. You know, recognize the sort of duality of mind and say, okay, well, since I think there's nice people and mean people, you know, my metta meditation will be more effective if I deliberately direct my meditation to those people who I think are mean people, you know. Really bring that up and acknowledge I have that feeling, you know, it's an illusion, but I think that way, you know. And bring my meditation towards people I think are nice people, and so on. So let me play the next verse, and I'll tell you what some of these words mean, and we'll call it a day. So we got into the second section. And so remember the three sort of categories of Buddhist teaching that they understand this sutra to address are sila, or virtue, samadhi, or meditation. So this is now meditation instructions. And panya, or prajna, or wisdom, you know, how to apply all this wisely. So let's listen to the next one, which is starting the list. You know, these beings that are in all different sort of categories. Different style. Problem with if we got into chantings and probably we have to choose which style, you know, how would we ever choose? They evolve in different cultures, you know. This is a Thai style from a monastery in Bangkok, it says. It's just like, it's so sort of metered, isn't it? That was verse 4.
Yeah, I
couldn't. You know, they were not enunciating the words in the same way, a different accent and a different style, but that was verse 4. Like, you can make out a few of the words, but yeah, it's hard. Neat, though. So, let's see. Maybe we just have time for the first couple of words and we'll break, but the first line literally means. All whatever beings, this pana bhut means it means like all living and breathing beings. The first line is just, again, all beings, we really mean it. And then the list starts with the second line, that tasa va tavara va anavesa. And that gets translated as weak or strong, but it's interesting, actually. I'm getting into the textual analysis. I hope this isn't boring to you. Okay, all right, so tasa and tavara mean respectively moving and stable, or not moving. So moving and not moving beings, which get translated as weak and strong. Now, how would you translate it? That the Western mode would probably be strong. The strong ones are moving, right? Strong ones are in motion, and the weak ones are like, you know, collapsed on the couch. So they're not moving, but it's the opposite. The opposite in the sort of Buddhist way of thinking, or an Asian way of thinking, or who knows where it comes from. But the way it's thought about here is the ones who are strong are able to be still, are able to embrace stillness. And the ones who are having difficulty are squirming around, you know, are moving. And we have to have compassion, you know, for the ones who have to move.
Would it also be like trees?
It's funny you would say that, because it turns out that these terms had a meaning. I wasn't even going to get into this, but you brought up these terms turned out to have an earlier meaning. I learned from Bhikkhu Bodhi in Indian philosophy before the Buddha, meaning exactly that: the non-moving ones are plants, and the moving ones are animals. Yeah. So yeah, how'd you know? Now we really wonder about rebirth. They just sounded familiar, you know. And then the next, well, I can say a little bit, we can finish the verse, I think, because the next one is more straightforward. So then the next, we have a list of sizes. Basically big ones, small ones, and medium-sized ones. And it works on, they run it on two axes, actually. The first list of big, small, and medium is long. Long ones, short ones, and medium ones. And then the second list is apparently means like density. So thick ones, you know, like dense ones, medium density ones, and like, you know, ephemeral, you know, airy ones. And there's some, and there actually are some Pali words in there you might recognize if you've looked at all into this literature. The first word, digha, means long or large. And one of the collections of these sutras is called the Digha Nikaya, so it's a collection of long sutras. And the first line of the first word of the second line there that I have on there, Majjhima, means shorter, Majjhima means medium. So there's a Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle length discourses, and I think Rakasa means short, but I forget. So anyway, I think it's kind of interesting too, because, you know, that wouldn't be our first cut on how to organize beings, I don't think. You know, I think we'd think, well, don't forget the long ones, you know. I'm worried I might forget the snakes, you know, and the really long worms, you know. We just wouldn't think about it that way. But the other thing to think about is it doesn't just mean, and they're going to get into this in the next verse, which we'll do next week, they don't just mean beings that we can see and touch either. So they're including a whole sort of broader cosmological sense of things, which includes five sort of planes of existence. And so we're on the human sort of level. And sharing this vision, and the only other level that's sort of visible to us are the animals, which are the next level down. And then below them are beings who are sort of, it's a little bit like purgatory, I guess. Sometimes the next beings down, it's the land of the hungry ghosts, the pretas. And these are beings who sort of don't know where they're at. They sort of can't be satisfied, and they're sort of stuck in between. And then below them are the hell realms, of which there are many. It's very graphic and complicated. There are many different kinds of hells. Although one thing about hells is they're varied and complicated and horrible, but they're not permanent. So the Christian hell is like permanent. So this, like everything else in Buddhism, is impermanent and conditioned. You know, conditions end up such that you end up in the hell realms, and then conditions change and you end up in another realm. And then there's one level above us, which is the level of the devas, like gods. It gets translated gods, but it doesn't really mean the same as Christian gods. These are beings who, like, you can't see them, but you can sense them sometimes. And they live a really, really long time, and they're, like, pretty happy, and it's, like, a problem for them. Because they're, like, pretty happy, but they're not quite, they can't quite get in light, they can't quite be released from this cycle, because they're sort of, like, stoned, you know, they're, like, blissed out all the time. And they kind of can't feel things very clearly, and, you know, they're a little fuzzy, you know. And they have these incredibly long lifespans. But the way it's understood in Buddhism is the most advantageous place to be, of course, is the human realm, because then you can feel your suffering and you can practice, and then that's the only sort of way out of the problem of existence, is to be able to practice. And so when they say medium, thick, and, you know, thin, they're also referring to these levels. And in the next verse, when they talk about seen and unseen, they're also talking about, you know, some of these levels can be seen and some can't be seen. And if we are disturbed by this kind of mythology because it's not familiar to us, we can still, I think, usefully understand it psychologically too, right? And on a moment-by-moment basis, right? We're in these five realms, you know, we're in all these five realms all the time, right? You know, given what's going on, you know, sometimes we're in hell realms, you know, and suddenly we're back in the human realm, and then we're in the deva realm, you know, and we think, oh, everything's fine, what was I worried about? You know, and then we're in the animal realm, you know. And then we see other people kind of going through these same cycles. And then, anyway, that's all I want to say about that. Any questions? Because I think we're about the end of our time.
Very quickly, I've read also about six realms and the top realm of gods being divided into demigods and then gods.
Yeah, sometimes they do six, sometimes they do five, yeah. And I think it's kind of the same idea. And I think it might be more, I'll have to look up who does six and who does five. I think it's roughly a Mahayana thing. Your Mahayana generally is more elaborated and complicated, you know. So yeah, and there's many, many different the devas live in many different heavens too, and they have different names, and there's also a whole sort of mythological world where this happens, with a big mountain in the middle and different lands, and you could travel, and in the different lands are different kinds of mystical trees, and yeah, it's quite elaborate and cool, you know.
Where does this come from?
Well, it's a sort of Buddhist elaboration on an Indian mythology. Yeah, the Buddhists sort of took the existing mythology of the time and sort of reimagined it in the light of these teachings, you know.
But so, like, is there two sides of Buddhism, the side of the spiritual stuff, or are they connected? Is it one, like, aim? You know what I mean? Like, the spiritual,
No, I think they didn't divide it up that way. I think that's kind of our sort of Western heritage, you know, that we think therefore we are and we're separate. I think they understood that all beings are, you know, all the time. You know, it looks to us like the human real world, but, you know, it looks like it's made out of wood and, you know, stuff to do. But actually we're in the middle of this huge cosmological world, and in this room with us for sure are devas and, you know, hungry ghosts and, you know, hell beings, and it's all kind of mixed together all the time. And that one of the effects of practice is becoming more sort of able to sense these different worlds, you know, the coexistence of these different worlds on every moment. Yeah. So yeah, I think they didn't quite see it that separately, and it's sort of, yeah, I think for them it was much more of a sort of unified sort of mytho, you know, psycho, you know, spiritual world, you know, all these things together. You know, that we have these scientific disciplines that sort of separate things. And I think they had a more sort of unified approach. At least that's my understanding. All right, to be continued. Next week I'll be in California, so we'll skip next week. If you want to hang around and talk about the Metta-Sutta, that'd be wonderful, but it's up to you. And then the week after that, we can continue and we'll finish, hopefully, the section on meditation and the different classes of beings and how to work with them according to the Metta-Sutta. And also that the meditation described here is not actually the meditation that most monks do, so that's interesting. That is described more in the commentaries. And then we'll have one more week and we'll hope to touch the end of the sutra, which is about wisdom and the sort of transcendent quality of all this stuff. So that's my goal anyway. Okay, thanks for coming.